Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with another Michael, Michael Solomonoff, hailing from Philly, the man behind Zaha, Federal Donuts, Percy's Barbecue, and soon...
Yeah, we just opened a Citron and Rose, too.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks for having
me, bro. Not busy at all, huh?
I don't know. I know. I'm like, we're escaping Philly today.
Yeah.
We're coming up to Brooklyn to kick it. So thanks so much for having me.
It's a nice little respite, you know, and it's warm in here on this cold day. Your journey is kind of fascinating. You know, arriving at the kind of cuisine that you make now was not a linear path in any which way. Born in Israel, in Tel Aviv. When did you move to Pittsburgh?
We moved when I was like three-ish or two-ish or something like that. Yeah.
Do you remember Israel? Do you remember eating there, the life, the culture?
You know, I remember the first couple of years after we moved that we went back a bunch. So a lot of my earlier memories, I think some memories as a child there, but a lot of my memories were sort of for the first couple of years moving back.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, as a young kid too, obviously it's a different palate than when you're an adult.
Totally.
Do you remember some of those flavors?
Absolutely. I think it's like, it's more than that. I mean, there's like flavors and smells and sounds and all those, and that's sort of it. And you can still, when you get off the airplane now as an adult, I can still get it, you know? In the winter, there's like orange blossom in the air and all that. And then there's the smell of like street food and, you know, coffee and obviously a shitload of cigarettes,
yeah,
you know?
And
so I think all those things are sort of like as one, you know?
Yeah. So the transition to Pittsburgh, a town known for what?
At the time, not much.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty depressing, I think. My mom's like family owned a jewelry store there that was pretty successful, and my dad wanted to like move to the States. You know, he's Israeli, so we wanted to move to the States and ended up being a jeweler. Ghost figure, right?
Yeah.
Israeli jeweler. Super novel.
Yeah.
And we ended up moving there, and you know, it was like, in retrospect, it was a really cool place to grow up, and we had a good, you know, it's like beautiful and there's a lot of you know, the topography is like very interesting and schools were good and we had like a nice little community, but it was, you know, it was boring. I was kind of used to something else. We moved back to Israel when I was like 15.
Yeah.
And I ended up in a boarding school in the north of Israel.
So that was in Birthright. That was the whole family picked up and moved back.
Yeah. I was like when it was like, yeah, when I was like fifth, like I think I was like a sophomore in high school.
Yeah.
My parents were like, hey, we're gonna go back, you know? It sucked at the time. It was a hard time to move. You're just sort of getting settled into, you know, whatever, sort of like post-adolescent, you know. It was crazy, actually.
Yeah, I was still trying to get settled.
I know. I was like the biggest asshole in the world to my parents. I was like, I'm going to make your life hell. So whatever, you know, drug using I'm going to do is going to increase and I'm going to get into trouble and all that. But it was cool. I mean, moving there was, you know, that was probably the most formative year of my life. And some of my best friends are from that year still. And, you know, it was like you and like, it was 40 kids on this, 40 like American kids that were so fucked up their parents were like, we're gonna send you to Israel to straighten you up, you know. And we ended up like, you know, it was like 40 of us on this like little farm sort of community, and it was we were like, you know, picking like oranges and pomelos and learning about the country and sort of not integrating necessarily, even though like more than half the kids stayed and sort of became Israeli. But it was really cool and so different from what I was used to in the States. I mean, if you grew up in middle or like upper middle class suburb or even metropolitan area anywhere in the States, you kind of have an idea of what your life is like, right? Everyone's kind of doing the same thing, and to be just sort of like whiplashed into a different culture where, you know, mannerisms are totally different, you know, humor is totally different. It was before the second intifada, so it was like freaking impossible to pick up women. It was so hard.
And I mean, you didn't even have Hebrew under your belt. You were an American kid.
Yeah, I was like an American kid. My parents, you know, I knew a couple words from like Hebrew school, but my parents generally spoke English unless they wanted me to like not know what they were talking about.
Yeah, and it's not like you can, you know, recite the Via Hafta at a bar and like
you can. The biblical shit doesn't work, dude. Yeah, you can't sing song like exactly like no nobody's gonna right nobody's gonna let you talk to them. But it was also cool because we were at the time. I mean, there was. Things were different there. Like, Rabin was still sort of in power, and things were looking really good for the country. And there were there were Russian immigrants and American immigrants, and then Ethiopians had started moving. So there were just all types of kids, you know, that had gone through so much. And we thought, you know, like, Americans were, you know, we had all these kids from, like, L.A. or Long Island or whatever, and we all thought we were tough guys until, like, the Russians moved in. And they would kick the shit out of us.
But, I mean, hearing these multi-culti, you know, Russian, Ethiopian coming in, it also kind of translates into Israel itself.
Totally.
Even though it's a state of, you know, what people think of, you know, Jewish, Zionist even, there are so many different people there.
And oh, it's amazing.
Speaking of food, too, I mean, within the Israeli or that sect of cooking, there are so many different influences as well.
Exactly. It's super relevant. And I think that was probably sort of an eye opener for that. I remember being in boarding school and we used to just go eat. We'd like smoke shitty cigarettes and drink vodka, which was like at the same time, the same, you know, it was the price of a pack of like Marlboro Reds. It was like a bottle of vodka. Yeah. And then every like third week, we'd have enough money to like walk down to the Yemenite restaurant and we'd have like bowls of Yemenite soup, which like was a very normal thing to do there, but like nobody does that kind of stuff here.
Can you explain what Yemenite is?
Well, Yemenite is obviously the style of food in Yemen, but in Israel, it's specific to the Jewish community that was for so long removed from the rest of the world. A lot of people think that Yemenite Judaism is sort of the purest form because they were like kind of the lost tribe.
Yeah.
The Ethiopians and the Yemenite were like the, you know, and they're actually one of the latest to immigrant.
Yeah.
Immigrate either to Israel. So
I mean, one of the few Yemeni like flavor profiles I know is it Hawaji?
Yeah, it's Hawaj. Yeah, Hawaj.
Hawaj.
Yeah, exactly.
And what does that comprise of?
Turmeric, cumin, black pepper is generally it. Lior Lev, our spice guy.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
He'll
who's been on this show before, and I must say I am addicted to Apollonia.
But oh my god, I know, it's like hard to stop, like rubbing on my gums and shit. It's so good, but he. You know, he'll insist on a couple different kinds of turmeric, and it depends on who you ask. But generally speaking, it's cumin, black pepper, and turmeric. But actually, hawaj is kind of the word like for curry with Yemenite food. There's like a couple different kinds of hawaj, and there's a coffee kind. They call it like white coffee, basically, and it's got like sesame seeds and peanuts in it.
Yeah.
You know, and cardamom, which is cool. And then there's like the one that we spoke of, which is the soup hawaj. You know,
yeah.
So it's. So that's, you know, that's like Yemenite cooking. That's one small, very, very small facet in like the Israeli scheme of things. So, yeah. But being introduced to that from like a, you know, I was like a middle class, like Jewish kid from the States. It was really, it was jarring and it was amazing. And, you know, you're sort of thrusted into this like globalism thing that you just never really knew existed.
So what other things, you know, like pizza and pierogies here,
Israel? We did the falafel stuff. I mean, truth be told, I was not that into food at the time.
Yeah.
But I mean, everything was like totally different. There's like different pastries that are all over the, you know, street. People eat their dessert there all the time. So it's like, you know, every time you'd go to somebody's house, it's like coffee, cake.
It's the land of milk and honey.
Exactly. It's almond milk, actually. Yeah. And date honey is what they're, or date molasses is the real reference. But yeah, so everybody eats sugar over there. There's no fucking Atkins. Nobody knows what that is even is, you know? And people just go out, man. Like, they go out. Like, I worked years later when I was 19. I started cooking there. So I was 18, actually. And I worked at this coffee shop that would literally stay open till 6 a.m. serving food on, like, a fucking Thursday.
Yeah.
Like, it was like a school night, you know? And it was the people, that's just what they do. They go out and bar. It's like, and I don't know, it's different. Nobody gets like shwasted, really.
Yeah.
I mean, they do, but not like.
It's more of a constant thing. If you're going to stay up till 6 a.m., it's not like you can, you know,
right.
Front load your
Well,
night.
And also, I think that it's just accepting. It's like alcohol isn't a thing. There's no prohibition over there. Nobody really gives a shit. I mean, now it's a little bit different. There's a little bit more, I guess, not violence, but I guess they're aware of like drunk driving.
Yeah.
You know, but it wasn't something you grew up like. You could do it if you wanted to. You could go to the store and buy beer whenever you wanted. So, like, really wasn't that big of a deal, you know? And so, staying up and eating is a big deal.
You talk about this transformative time in your life, and you kind of glossed over that you just started working in a bakery.
Mm-hmm.
This was a choice to work in food, or was this just a job?
Well, I had no like skill set. I was like, I dropped out of college, you know, and I was like a photo major, and my Hebrew sucked. So the only job I could really get was like in this bakery, and it was like, you know, pretty awesome. And I mean, by awesome, I mean like terrifying and great. And also, you know, I was like an immigrant worker, which was very interesting, a good experience, I think, at the time.
Burekas.
Burekas, made a shitload of burekas. And I was sort of infatuated with burekas because I was a really picky eater, but my grandmother would make these burekas, which are these Balkan sort of pastries. Yeah. They're actually Sephardic, so they're kind of like, they call it Spanish dough, you know, and it's really a laminated dough similar to puff pastry and stuffed with like, you know, feta cheese and potatoes and olives or, you know, eggplant, mushrooms, that kind of thing. Yeah. And I was obsessed with those as a kid. And then as an adult, I got to make them. And at first, I was like, man, I didn't even think I was going to be a chef, but I was like, I should open a burekas shop in the States. They're on every single street corner in Israel.
Yeah. I mean, the only place I know them are in the Diamond District, you know, Apropoli, yeah. And you have to climb up, you know, 3 flights of stairs to have a burekas from That's like crazy. A weird glass sliding window. And
dude, I know. Whenever we go back to Israel, my wife, who's not Israeli, is like turns into like a Boreka monster, man. It's like Boreka crazy. I'm a Boreka me crazy. That sounds like the shop that we should own together here.
Or,
in
I mean, it could be a dance hall and it could be a Boreka dancing.
Boreka dancer, yeah. Right? Exactly.
Terrible, terrible ideas, but now we have them on air and they will never be forgotten.
I know.
So, from Borekas, when did you move back to the States and start attending culinary school?
Well, I mean, I did the Boreka thing, and then I got a job working at the cafe, and I sort of knew at that point that I was going to cook after that. It was like the intensity of it and the just the spirit of it. You know, there's something, I don't know. I mean, you find out, you know, what you love and you sort of like pursue that, and that's what I was doing. I had no idea that there was like a career to be had, and quite honestly, I was used to like, you know, whatever, selling pot and like not doing anything with my life. So it was like everybody was super psyched, like, oh, Michael's into something that won't like get him arrested or killed. So it was you know, everyone was super psyched in my family about that, and I had this work ethic now that was sort of like ingrained in me a little bit from being in Israel.
You know, the foundation of cooking obviously is mainly French, right. Starting to become more and more Italian here in the States. And you worked in some amazing restaurants in Philly,
right?
You know, Vetri amongst them, which is an Italian restaurant. What happened? Why did you come back to Israel? Why that cuisine?
Well, I mean, when I was cooking at Vetri, I was there for a couple of years. Actually, I was there for a year, and I was about to be like sort of promoted as sous chef. And I'd gone. So at one point there was only Vetri. You know, that was the only restaurant he owned. He's got a couple of restaurants now, but he ran it like super Italiano style, which means like in the summer we would close for Saturday Sundays.
Yeah,
and then in the summer he would also close the restaurant for like 2.5 weeks in August, which is what I guess everybody does. Those days are far from gone. far gone now. But so I started there. I was working at Stripe Bass. I got a job there. And then in August, we closed, and I went back to Israel. And I hadn't been there in like 4 years. And I had a younger brother named David who was in the army. He was a sniper in an infantry unit called Golani. And he and I hadn't really spent that much time together. And my mom was like, you have to come home. You haven't seen your brother. You know, like, so I came home, and we kicked it for a couple weeks and just kind of went to the beaches, and he was younger, and it was like kind of the first time we had not fought all the time. Like, we were, you know, we were just like brothers, not younger brother, not older brother. We unsuccessfully went out to pick up girls, and we would like go like disco tech dance, you know, like just it was all, you know, it was just cool, man. It was like really, really cool. And we did a lot of eating. It was the first time I'd gone back and sort of been a chef or been really interested in cooking since I'd lived there. And I came back to the States, and a month later he was killed, actually. And he was exiting, actually. He was about 3 days away from his completion of army service, and he happened to be in the border of Lebanon and was patrolling, and there was like a sensor set off, and he was with a group of people and killed from Hezbollah snipers were like in Lebanon and fired in and killed him. So, you know, that was obviously hard, you know, to deal with, I mean, to say the least, but it was sort of transformative. I had never thought I would be cooking Israeli food, and then sort of after that, I just got drawn to it, you know, and I cooked for years under Mark. And Mark Vetri came with me after Dave was killed to Israel, and we went up to the border and actually cooked for his unit.
Yeah.
For like over 100 cooks or 100 soldiers rather. And I just, I don't know, you know, it just sort of, it was natural to me after that. Like I got a job. It became more and more clear, although I loved cooking Italian food, that like I wasn't going to be happy doing that. And I took a job with the owner of a restaurant called Marigold Kitchen. It was this little sort of 35-seat BYOB in West Philly. And he's now my business partner and, you know, sort of best friend. He just kind of let me cook what I wanted to, and I started just using Israeli ingredients. And it was kind of like American-European, but with, like, an Israeli nod. And after a little bit of time, I was like, we should just do Israeli food.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's doing it. You know, there's, like, shitty falafel shops or the Boreka shops in the Diamond District or whatever. But nobody understands the sort of richness of this, like, of these cultures that make up this country that have all moved out. You know, they moved back from, like, the diaspora sort of after Babylon. They've moved back to this country, this land, and they're all sort of, they're bringing it, you know? They're all cooking this amazing food, and I just wanted to do it. And it was a way to do something interesting, to do something fun, and from, you know, a chef's point of view, it's, like, fucking awesome. There's so many things going on there at once, and it's, like, Middle Eastern, it's Mediterranean, you know, it's Balkan, it's like Lebanese, it's Syrian, it's all this stuff in one place. You know, and like sort of like where, you know, modern farming began and modern winemaking began. And it was also a way for me to like, you know, represent the country a little bit. Like I, you know, it's like, it was pretty fucked up after my brother, you know, was killed. And it was really hard to, I didn't know for a while. I was like, oh, maybe I'll move back to Israel. I was actually working out and I was working out and like training and like, you know, running with like weights and shit. Cause I literally thought I was going to move back and like join the military and like whatever. And it was just, you know, it took a long time for me to get okay or comfortable with where we are now, which is like me obviously trying to promote the country as best as I can.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And although on a somber note, we're going to come back and talk about the gold that you found in Zahav.
Awesome.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Did you know that pollinators are needed for more than two-thirds of the world's crop species? Most of these pollinators are bees. However, North America's bee population has been steadily declining since the 1990s. Whether you live in the country or the city, you can show your commitment by hosting a hive in your backyard or even on a rooftop. The beekeeping movement is growing, so you're sure to find swarms of folks who can help you find your way. Learn more about the ways you can help be the solution at WholeFoodsMarket.com/sharethebuzz.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Michael Solomonoff, aka Mike Solo.
Just call me Mike Solo.
Zahav, it means the word gold, right?
Yeah.
It was, well, more than a diamond in the rough, in an area of Philly, Society Hill, which is better known for what kind of businesses and buildings?
Well, I mean, we're like in the sort of at the base of the Society Hill Towers, which is like this big sort of architectural thing that I.M. Pei built in the 60s, I guess, late 60s or early 70s. So there wasn't really a lot going on there. And we opened there. It happened to be this shitty Italian restaurant that had the guy brought in a guy from Naples to build this wood-burning oven. So we're like, oh, cool, we've got a tabun, which is like an Arabic oven. So it was like, check, you know. And it's kind of, it's like in a peculiar area, but now we're fine with that.
Yeah. But I mean, when you turn the corner and see that thing sitting on the hill, it must have some kind of, feels like a biblical reference almost.
Well, it's weird. I mean, I remember the day that we put that sign up and Steve and I like walked across the street and looked up and I was like, well, this is for real now.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's cool. I mean, you know, it's a weird area, I guess, but it's kind of what it is, man. I mean, every restaurant is so freaking difficult in so many different ways. And everyone's like, oh, the location sucks. I'm like, I don't know. I mean, right now, we're like sitting in the back of a pizza shop and like, what? I don't know. What was here before? Not much, right?
That's a good question. When things turn over in New York, I have no idea.
I remember hanging out with my buddy in Bed-Stuy like 10 years ago, and he was like, there's like a 75% chance your car is going to get stolen tonight. And it didn't, but a homeless guy definitely took a shit on the front tire. Yeah. And now it's like an unaffordable area. So,
oh, well, no, now it's 50% in piss.
Yeah, so. Right.
It just downgraded.
So, I mean, it's kind of a weird area, but it doesn't really matter. I mean, we opened an Israeli restaurant in Philly in 2008, which is like in sort of reasonable terms would be the worst business decision one could ever make. And we ended up, you know, the first year was like incredibly difficult, but it worked. And it worked because our concept is always sort of changing, and we're always trying to do things that are exciting and new, and we're trying to sort of bring it. And we had this idea that we would do this like really authentic food, and then next to it do like really high end. You know, we had this little thing I wanted to kind of show off and do like a tasting menu kind of thing. It was called The Quarter, and so I'd do like separate menus and do this, and it just ended up being really confusing. And we were in this predicament. We're like in like eastern Pennsylvania, you know, which is not a very different climate than like Israel, right? And so like, you know, 8 months out of the year, you don't have cucumbers and tomatoes, and you're like, well, what the fuck do I do? So we had to adjust, and we had to change, and we had to make it more relevant, and our customers totally embraced that. And it became, you know, people call it modern Israeli. It's not. It's like relevant Israeli cuisine. You know, we're not. If you're in Israel and you're like, I want Bulgarian like kebabs, you go to a Bulgarian restaurant. You know, and we can absorb that and kind of make it our own and have that right next to like fresh couscous that we make every day for a Moroccan dish. You know?
Though you use the word relevant, was there a lot of education? Because I don't think a lot of people understood what kind of cuisine you were serving at first. I mean,
they still don't exactly. Yeah. But that's part of the. Part of the allure, I think.
I mean, you even look at the breakdown, and excuse me if I'm mispronouncing this, but like saltim, mezes, shipadim, I mean.
Yeah, shipadim, right, exactly.
What are these things?
Well, I mean, these are things that you get all over there. So saltim are salads, and like, you know, the biggest thing was like when you order salads here, you get a bunch of like little salads. You don't get like a fucking Caesar salad with like fucking fried shrimp or whatever. It's not like one of those things. It's like a bunch of little tastes, and vegetables are a huge part of Israeli cuisine.
Fried cauliflower.
We do like pickled beets. We've got like, you know, the legumes that have been like, you know, poached in like tomato with coriander served at room temperature. You know, it's stuff that I want to eat all the time. And it's stuff that you get. You sit down in a restaurant in Israel and they bring over a shitload of plates. And that's, we wanted to bring that here. You know, our hummus is, we like to make it as Israeli as possible, meaning that we used tons of tahini paste. I don't know how you guys call it here, but we call it trina. And, you know, it's really rich and really nutty and not very garlicky and lemony, which most people are used to here, the sort of Greek and Turkish.
Yeah, and you serve about four different kinds.
We do. We serve that. We do hot fava beans, the dried fava beans that we stewed with, you know, coriander and caraway. And then we have musabaha, which is like hot chickpeas rolled in trina, put in the middle of it. So you get like this hot-cold sort of contrast thing. And then our Turkish, which is sort of an idea I got from Anas Ortun from Oleana. She travels tons in Turkey, and in central Turkey, the dairy quality is so high, they actually do melted butter.
Wow, yeah.
And when we were in Turkey, they heat up. It's like cool. They put it in like a earthenware kind of dish, and they like bake it with like pine nuts. And I was like, man, got to do that. Yeah. You know? Sort of like the French meats. I don't know. It was awesome. So, and it's so different than what we do, and I feel like in the winter, it makes a lot of sense. So,
but it's not all hummus on the menu. That's another preconception, I think, of a lot of Middle Eastern cuisines, that, you know, you start with hummus. So it's nice to see all these other, you know, small salads.
Totally.
Mezes, I've got to say the crispy halloumi with the date is one of my favorite dishes I've had maybe ever.
I appreciate it.
I mean, it's just kind of mind-blowing texturally and flavor profile-wise, because growing up Ashkenazi and having things like kreplach or, you know, cholent, something stewed and dark, to have such bright flavors and such great texture is that Sephardic side, which I never encountered.
Yeah, I mean, that's great, because that taps into the sort of the Greek and Turkish thing going on. And there's obviously, you know, like my grandparents, I mean, they immigrated, you know, from Bulgaria, and at a time when people are moving from Bulgaria, they went through Turkey, they went through Greece, and they, you know, got to Israel. What's relevant about that dish that not a lot of people know about is the date paste that we use. That we get that's from a kibbutz in Israel called Kibbutz Kinneret. It's like the second oldest kibbutz, so it predates modern independence. And the owner of that kibbutz, or the guy that founded that, had to smuggle date palms back from all over the Middle East illegally, to Israel. The Ottomans, when they sort of took over, they burned all the date palms. So this guy went out and brought, so 90% of all the dates that are in Israel are brought back basically by this guy.
Yeah.
And so, and they freaking like deliver a date paste to like Walmart here in the States.
That's
and
awesome.
We get a distributor that sells it. So it's awesome. It's sort of like a sweet, sour, it tastes like French toast in a weird way. Yeah. I don't even know.
But I mean, you don't have one of those menus which, you know, gives the backstory of each dish, because no. It would be a Bible. It would be a Torah. It would be humongous.
It would be. And also, like, we want it, you know, we're changing. Like, we want it, the menu and the experience, it's all have to be sort of living and breathing. And when you start getting absolute with that stuff, it's, that hasn't worked out very well.
Kebabs, kofta. What are shippudims?
Shippud means it's like the stick. It's a skewer. So shippudim, there's like, if you go to like a skewer, like a kebab house in Israel, it's called shippudia, you know? And, so that's part of our menu, or part of like the sort of proteins that we cook, I guess. It'd be kind of the entree, even though it's small plates. We cook everything over charcoal, and generally most of it's on sticks, whether it's like, you know, ground duck with like foie gras and pistachios, or ground beef and ground lamb. We were cooking beef cheeks last winter in coffee and then glazing them on the grill as well. Let's see. What are we doing today? We had some VIPs in. We were doing some lobster on the stick, which is pretty dope.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about kosher a little bit later, but tasting menus, you have the misibah. Then what is the big hunk of lamb that you put in front of the table?
So before we opened the restaurant, I had a Passover Seder at the restaurant under construction. After my brother died, my Mark Vetri and I, we'd always do Passover Seders at his restaurant. And then he was like, hey, now that you have a restaurant, can we do this at your place? Yeah. You know? And so I was like, yeah, sure. We'll, you know, invite my, you know, my family wanted to come up and sort of see the restaurant, and we were delayed. So we were under construction and like had all these people in the restaurant, and we were like, had to cook a Passover Seder. And, we like, you know, I had like lamb shoulder and I had pomegranate juice and all that. And we ended up creating this dish that we served that night before we even opened, like it was 2 weeks before we opened, I think. And then it just became a signature dish. We, brine lamb shoulder, sort of bone in, and then we cook it over charcoal, or actually recently we've been smoking it at our barbecue restaurant, and then we braise it in pomegranate juice with chickpeas that have only been soaked, so they're still kind of raw, but then you throw them in and they absorb like all the lamb fat and all the pomegranate juice, and then we roast that and glaze it, and we serve it with like a big freaking bowl of like Persian rice. So we cook rice with turmeric and saffron, and then get it crispy on the bottom and just serve it with it. Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that is a true party time.
It is a party time, you're right.
But again, you mentioned Persian cuisine, and mm-hmm. we talked about Yemenite. I mean, there are so many different references, and there are more, like Aleppo.
Aleppo, Syria, totally. Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. Like, and I was trying to explain this to the guy. We, you know, before we opened the restaurant, we brought over like a whole group of people. And I was like, you have to, like, I can't explain this. You just kind of need to see it. And a huge, I think an eye-opening moment for everybody was going to like my dad's place for Shabbat lunch. Cause his, you know, his family, is Bulgarian. And then his neighbor, he dates their daughter, from way back, and they sort of immigrated in the 50s. So he is dating her, and their family's Romanian. And then I've got a half sister and her husband's Persian. So, like, everybody shows up with food, and it's just, like, crazy time. You know, my Persian brother-in-law, he, like, makes rice and kills it. He cuts an onion in his hand. That's, like, how he grew up. It's just, like, insane, right? So he makes this amazing rice, and then we get these, like, Romanian kebabs that are, you know, have, like, a shitload of garlic and, you know, paprika. And then, you know, the Bulgarian, we get, like, the pastel, like, the pastries and all that stuff. And it's all in one place, you know? And that is, I feel like, the analogy for Israel. You know, it's all sort of there. It's all there, dude.
Yeah.
It's all of it.
And then with your new restaurant, Citron Rose,
yeah.
Going glatt kosher,
mm-hmm.
not being able to mix meat and dairy.
Right.
What are, obviously, it's happened for years, so it's not necessarily a struggle to make that cuisine. But as a restaurant, what are the struggles that are ahead trying to reintroduce this idea of really great tasting glatt kosher food?
Well, I mean, I think that, again, it's like people aren't really doing it. So for us, you know, we have Zahav and we wanted to do something different. After we opened Zaha, we actually spent a little bit of time in Montreal just kind of checking out the... Because that, you know, that's like an Ashkenazi community that was brought over from Europe that sort of changed the way people think about pastrami or... You know, they were doing the OG charcuterie, right? They were making, like, preserved meat and brining and this and that. And So we'd been developing this sort of concept in our heads for a while, and my business partner, Steve, grew up more with Ashkenazi food than I did, and we kept talking about why people weren't really kind of doing that. And we were approached by this philanthropist in Philly. His name is David Magerman, and he really wanted a kosher restaurant. And we were like, well, this would actually make sense. I mean, the last thing we want to do is open up a restaurant that has no meaning, right? Like, I don't want to open a kosher restaurant just to, like, tap into this, like, kosher demographic to try to make some money. I mean, there's much easier ways than making money than opening a fucking kosher restaurant, right? Like, anything. But we are, you know, we're doing really well, and we've only been open a couple weeks because it's, like, a cool restaurant. We're doing, you know, we went to Budapest and we went to Paris, and we wanted to, like, kind of explore this thing. I mean, you said it yourself. You're, like, chant and, like, kreplach, and those are things that we have on the menu. But, I mean, we, in Hungary, man, they, like, smoke goose legs and put them in with a chant, or they, you know, they'll, like, you know, poach eggs really, really slowly and lightly. They use tons of foie gras, tons of bone marrow, tons of paprika, you know. And Paris, obviously, I mean, kosher food there. We went into these salami places. They have, like, 40 different kinds of salamis, or they have all this, like, botarga that they're kosher botarga, things that you just wouldn't ever expect. And these are things that people have been doing for thousands of freaking years. And it's just, like, gone.
Yeah.
Nobody knows. You know, like, you hear... what are the blintzes? Like, that is not... I mean, that is obviously a part of Jewish cooking, but there is a lot to it. You know, Jews were freaking nomads for thousands of years, and they... You know, there's obviously a lot of really exciting cooking traditions that we wanted to explore.
Yeah, and it's not co-opted, like you said. It's nomadic, and it came back to a place to be able to present it to everybody else. And that is the heartwarming part of, you know, your cuisine and your people's... Our people's cuisine.
Our people.
I'm pure blood.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Nice.
I will take you to Schnitzies or Schnitzel King someday in Brooklyn. Because that's another kind of weird Ashkenazi Sephardic mix-up thing that, you know, is out in Borough Park and not many people get to.
No, it's cool. I mean, I think there are all those things. Boreka shop, schnitzel sandwiches, Jerusalem Grill. Have you ever had that?
No.
Oh, my God. They take, like, chicken spleen, chicken heart, chicken yada yada, turkey this, turkey that, and they put it on a griddle and you know marinate it and sear it up, and then they stuff it into a pita. It's called Jerusalem Grill. It's awesome.
That does not sound too shabby.
It doesn't. It doesn't. We put it on the menu at Zaha when we were, like, grilling duck testicles.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to gloss over Federal Donuts.
You don't want to gloss over duck testicles.
Yeah.
That's what you were about
to say. I've had plenty of duck fries in my life, and I remember them all. But, you know, you have Percy's Texas style barbecue. You have Federal Donuts,
yeah,
which donuts and fried chicken,
totally
amazing. What are the same kind of, you know, modes and methods that you implore into those restaurants that you do with Zahav and Citron and Rose?
Well, I mean, that's a great question, because it's hard. You know, we've got such a diverse sort of handful of these restaurants that we want our customer to feel a certain way, regardless of where they're at. If they're waiting in line for chicken and donuts in the morning, or they're at Zahav, like, you know, elbows deep in lamb shoulder, or they're at Citron and Rose and they've driven 2 hours from Brooklyn or Lakewood, New Jersey to, like, have dinner, we want, you know, I don't know, I'm going to sound, like, totally cheesy, like a motivational speaker, but, you know, every customer, especially now, they've got choices. They can go anywhere they want. And the fact that they've come to one of our establishments makes them special. Like, they should be treated special, whether it's like an extra donut while they're waiting in line, or like a donut for their kid, or it's a hob. I mean, we have like a lot of regular customers, and we want to blow people away. And whether it's like a visit from me or an extra meze, or, you know, if they're like Lebanese, we send out Lebanese Arak, or if they're a Percy Street, I mean, we have people that, you know, moved from Texas to Philly that are fucking screwed. They don't know where to eat, you know? And it's like, those things really matter. So I think that there's, like, service, and then there's hospitality. And I think that level of hospitality is just really identifying what it's going to take to create a memory, right? Because that's kind of all you got, right? You leave a restaurant and, like, you could go back or you could not, but you want to be touched. You want, like, a connection. You want to feel special. And I think that that's what we try to do.
It's kind of like that first time you went back to Israel. It's always trying to create that feeling again for all your customers.
Look, that's the best form of flattery that we could get at Zahav, is people that have been like, you know, I've been to Israel and I've tasted these things. never quite like this, and this like totally brings me back. It's as good as it gets, you know.
Yeah, I've never been, but I've already felt like I've been transported, and I will be back.
Well, you're coming, baby.
And I'm coming to Israel.
Coming to Israel,
no doubt about it. Mark my words, on air, I will go.
Awesome.
One last selfish question,
please.
How do you make the best shakshuka? It is one of my favorite dishes ever.
Oh, shakshuka is the key to shakshuka. Good shakshuka is cooking out the liquid in the tomatoes. So what you want to do is you want to use a good amount of onions and garlic and really cook them down, and then add your peppers and like slightly sweat the peppers so they have a little bit more of a presence. And then you put in your tomatoes and cook the hell out of the tomatoes, and you can actually add a little bit of sugar too. Some people add sugar. We're getting this really, really dope Israeli honey from the Negev that has got all these like cool savory things going on. So we'll always like, we'll kind of like glaze the peppers and the tomatoes immediately in honey. So when they cook down, they sort of caramelize. And then just really good eggs.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Well, that's my secret.
If you're not enticed, hungry, or fascinated by this episode to go to Philly, check out Zahav and Citron and Rose and all your other restaurants.
Thanks, bro.
Or even take the trip to Israel and really see, you know, what you're trying to do here in the country and doing so well.
Thank you very much.
I don't know how I can convince you otherwise, because this is it. This is real. This is great.
And I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. We're like totally honored. Yeah. And we'll see you in Israel very shortly.
Excellent.
Bro. All right?
Great. Thanks, Michael. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.